Welcome to the Telltale Heart, a Pharmacist Cardiovascular Digest. I'm excited to introduce in our really first episode, of course we had the introduction episode last week, to provide an overview of a timely topic relatedly that has just come out in the past several weeks, which are the acute coronary syndrome guidelines. I'm thrilled to have an important guest in my life or my mind to be on this introductory episode, Dr. Steve Dunn, and I'll allow him to introduce himself. He is a friend and mentor of mine. In fact, I could argumentatively say he's one of the people that taught me a lot about ACS and acute coronary syndrome in my career. And to the point, I got the privilege of being a peer reviewer for these most recent sets of guidelines, and definitely could thank and channel all my learnings from Dr. Steve Dunn here and Dr. Tracy McCauley when I was in training. So it'll be fun to pick his brain about the acute coronary syndrome guidelines and where it's at today and how he's applying it in a practice. So welcome. It's hard for me to, I'll call you Steve, but Dr. Dunn,
no,
welcome
Steve
to the
is fine.
Podcast. Yeah. So tell us a little about who you are and your current role and where you're located.
Yeah. So I assume, obviously we have a relationship, but really, I think I was asked to be on this podcast probably first because, I'm at the University of Virginia, and this podcast is at least in part named after Edgar Allan Poe. We have
Correct.
a dorm room for Edgar Allan Poe on UVA's grounds. Of course, can't call it campus, but we have preserved and shrined Edgar Allan Poe on the UVA campus. And, I assume that's at least part of why I'm here is to help
You know
reflect the
what?
spirit.
I know, as a Virginian, Steve knows I'm originally a Virginian. I am very aware of the connection with Edgar Allan Poe and everything. And I definitely, when I was thinking about creative titles, immediately thought of this story. Definitely does not have a direct connection to the topic, but I did not actually think about the UVA connection. So that just adds a layer of, just amazingness to this whole first episode, for sure.
Yeah, a little mystery here, but
Yeah.
a little channeling of our literary giants in the past. So yes, I'm Steve Dunn. So I'm at the University of Virginia. So I'm the team lead or the lead pharmacist for the Heart and Vascular Center there. So I help provide clinical leadership for our cardiology pharmacy team, which is mostly on the inpatient side, but we have sort of a ever increasing number of pharmacists in the outpatient practice as well. And while I think don't really help them as much with the day to day, and probably like the elder, I guess, of all of these people, which is a funny thing to say now, but I guess it's been a while in practice. So, but yeah, I would say I primarily work on the inpatient side, do a lot of CCU practice, and certainly see ACS every day of my life, professionally, and usually not in my personal life, but occasionally it's come up, and it's been
Sure.
handy.
Well, it's like I was about to say, I dare to ask, you deal with ACS in your day-to-day function. I feel like a lawyer by the end, but yes, I would, knowing you and knowing where you're at, and even your historical perspective, I can very much attest personally that Steve knows how to manage and be a part of acute coronary syndrome from that standpoint. So I guess kind of an early context before we jump into this, and it definitely impacts a lot of the things that are in the current guidelines, but just if you think about roughly, we haven't had a full per se defined acute coronary syndrome guidelines. There historically was, we had the NSTEMI guidelines at one point, we had the STEMI guidelines at one point,
yeah,
we had revascularization guidelines years ago, and those were a
secondary
conglomeration
prevention,
of things, and now they've kind of tried to umbrella them back together. What in the last several years, what are the changes and impetuses in, the area of what we think of acute coronary syndrome since, early, those are what, like 2014, 2013, and when those guidelines were maybe last published? What are things that have really been escalated in the ACS arena that are coming to us that make the formation of some of these guidelines that are, or what's going to be in the guidelines in 2025?
Yes, I think from my point of view, like when you go back to when all these guidelines were fragmented, to me, when I read these and of course looked at, from thinking from a historical perspective where we've come, a lot of what the previous guideline updates felt like were transitional. Meaning there's a whole lot of evidence base for ACS therapies that are pre-revascularization. And by that meaning a lot of pre-thrombolytic, pre-PCI data. And when you saw these older guidelines, I think a lot of those tried to straddle both worlds, in that we know some of these data are historical, but we're still going to kind of like try to translate them to the modern side. And I think when I've, just from a big picture view, when I read these new guidelines, they really feel contemporary in a way that they haven't in the past. Where now we're kind of pushing aside some of these things that have been a little bit, I guess, anachronistic and, older. And in some cases, now that we're getting more randomized data for, are not even as, I think it's a part of contemporary practice. So that was one thing that struck me in looking at these, is these feel like kind of clean and modern in a way that the guidelines before hadn't. I think in terms of like just big ticket things, I think one of the things they really want us to take away, and they, I always like to look at the guideline at a glance publication that's a companion with the guideline. But one of the big things they want to really emphasize is it's not just a statin ball game anymore with lipid lowering. And to really start to edge us towards, lowering the LDL goal to, under 70, including really ubiquitous usage of non-statin therapies, and even to consider goals of 55 or below, which is not something I think that was hugely on our radar. We'd seen some updates in the secondary prevention guidelines that address that, but gone are the days where we could check high intensity statin box and move on round. So we have to pay a little bit more attention to that topic. And then, I think the other big thing is just trying to look at and make sense of where we're at with DAP duration, and also which agent that is used, which is really kind of a spaghetti landmine of literature if you try to delve into it and make sense of it. And I think despite their efforts, it's still pretty confusing, like, when you do what, where. The good news is, at least from an ACS perspective, this has been unchanged for 20 years, is that if you have an ACS event, 12 months of DAPT is reasonable. But then it gets really like kind of diced up a lot more if we want to try to shorten that for any particular reason. And then I think the probably other big things with this are just really integrating some of the secondary prevention stuff a little bit more into this guideline. They address pericarditis, which I don't recall having seen, at least in the past, in which agents that we should use, a little bit more comprehensive secondary prevention. We're starting to see, the cementation of, I don't think that's a word, cementing, yeah, of
Solidifying, right?
solidifying, whatever.
Yeah.
Of the preferred diabetes drugs, GLP-1s, SGLT2s, integrated in here. And yeah, just a lot of things that I think that were scattered into different guidelines that have been a part of official guideline statements before, but the first time they've really kind of married them together. And the only other thing I would say about DAPT is just, and they've kind of like paid some eye towards this before with high intensity, more modern antiplatelet drugs like clopidogrel, or sorry, not like clopidogrel, like prasugrel and ticagrelor, and really saying these are preferred in most cases now if somebody isn't a high bleeding risk, which it feels like the end of an era, I think, to some degree. And now I think with improved access to some of these therapies in the U.S., it's really a page turning event in my
Yeah,
mind.
well, so a couple things to unpack there.
Yeah.
So let's talk about pre-reperfusion constructs. And so you said there is no more use of mnemonics, if you will. And I assume you're referring to you maybe know Mona, or they've downplayed some
Yeah.
of this piece. I think that's a large legacy for people. So kind of describe what maybe some of the changes are, where we're at with what we think about those things. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can essentially, I think, we all grew up learning that, and I still hear it like today from students when I bring it up. So, well, you might have learned about like pre-reperfusion or pre-revascularization therapies, and someone wants to spit out Mona at me, and I'm just like, no. And a lot of that is just what we found out more about those things is that they're obsessively focused on oxygen supply demand, which I think is a forest for the trees kind of argument in ACS. Yes, that's the root of the problem, but the interventions designed to augment that are not helpful, and in some cases may be harmful in the case of oxygen or in the case of morphine. And so the guidelines now are emphasizing revascularization is the default and the preferred, and all this other stuff is kind of nonsense that we're not even really going to talk about, with the exception of antiplatelet therapy. And I think that's still a bit of an open question about how aggressive to be. There's not really been great reperfusion pre-revascularization data with P2R12 inhibitors, for example. So they tried that, emergency medicine response trial with ticagrelor. There's still some investigational, I don't know if you've heard about these like sub-Q P2R12 inhibitors for high-risk people that in theory you inject yourself if you're having an
We're
event.
waiting
We'll
for that's the SOS AMI study that we're
yeah,
waiting for.
exactly.
And
So
I'm
we'll
lots of different questions. That'll be another podcast for another day.
yeah.
But no, I
But
agree with you. I
a
think
lot of
that
that,
the
we just haven't seen any real benefit of that yet. So I think for the most part, the whole goal with pre-revascularization is to get the patient to, a reperfusion facility as quickly as possible.
No, absolutely. And I think, part of that is to your point about antiplatelets up front is, understanding what you're dealing with and how you're gonna to get if it's an NSTEMI, obviously getting it on board relatively quickly, knowing that they may eventually go to the lab. Now the question is that, as we get more in day and age, what if they have to go to surgery? I think to your point, and you can probably attest to this, I think at some point CT surgeons felt okay about doing surgery on clopidogrel. They didn't love it, but they got some
Yeah.
acceptance with it and what to do with the newer agents and so forth. But you're right. I think it's not as well defined still, what to do. And I think it's still a lower recommendation about preloading in some of these instances, STEMI being different, but for sure. Now, you mentioned, of course, the whole construct with antiplatelet therapy. After, and I love what you were saying about, the ticagrelor piece, and they still call out 12 months default for, for patients with ACS. However, to your point about high risk bleeding, that it being less than that, I feel like, does that feel different than what the messaging has been over the years based on the trial data? And they do give a specific call to ticagrelor monotherapy for as one option. And do you just feel, well, there's been lots of trials about this, lots and lots of trials. So
Right.
I guess, what are you guys defining as high bleeding risk, or how are you making that decision to transition if you're going to transition at that 1 month mark or beyond, not wait, not keep them on for 12 months.
We don't have a good way to, I don't know, to really define like high bleeding risk over a 12-month interval, other than like age and some obvious comorbidities. And I think there's the whole sidebar of them being on chronic anticoagulation as well, which I think is thoroughly addressed now. And I think could even be stronger that we really should be treating those patients differently. And I think there was a real initiative, and this is part of where I think they're still straddling legacies. And so the 12-month ACS DAPT data is all the way back from CURE and those trials. And that is a completely different era of treatment. And I think most of the trials now have been looking at, either shorter durations of DAPT or, P2I monotherapy with, particularly the more potent P2R12 inhibitors, which I think is, really reasonable. And I think we're starting to get more and more data that that's probably okay, to look at, except for perhaps the very early, phase of ACS. But, I think it's just a time, I think, where they're still straddling the legacy of CURE. The other thing that has happened in the background, which is not, necessarily our field, but what's changed in terms of revascularization and drug-eluting stents has been like completely different. So we're on what fifth, sixth generation stents, and a lot of the thrombogenicity of those stents based on their ability to injure the intima, which really drives a lot of that pathophysiology, is a lot lower now. And so,
Well, we're also
seeing,
using a lot more vascular imaging than we ever did too, right?
yeah, absolutely, yeah. And so, just seeing the rate of stent thrombosis drive down, it makes like I think the benefit potentially less. So if I had to like throw a crystal ball, in the mirror, I would probably guess that even 12 months of DAPT is probably not necessary for most people. If I was like, really to listen to my heart, no pun intended, about this. But I think we just have to wait for data to catch up to that. And so I think in the context of an ACS event, we still don't really know. So I think as we get more data over time, because apparently it's really easy to do these PCI studies because there's one coming out like every week looking at
That's what I mean. That's why it feels like the messaging is like, we have so many. I'm going to say this tongue in cheek. I'm like, I've quit paying attention to them or keeping up to them. And that's not true, but it's just like, it's exhausting to keep up
It is.
with
The
them.
ones I try to pay attention to are at least the ones because they feel very cherry-picked too. So I really try to pay attention to the ones that are the highest risk people. So if it's not an ACS or even like a high risk ACS patient population, I don't know that it matters anymore. I think that seems to have been put to bed at this point, that we probably don't need long durations of DAPT in those patients. But so I think as we get more of those trials over time and the stents kind of keep improving, we'll probably start moving away from routine DAPT and probably even, or if we are, it's going to be a early phase, short phase aspirin utilization, I think.
Sure. And you mentioned the lipids, and this is kind of fits into maybe conversations around transitions or transition of care. And I'd love, in my opinion, I love the fact that they were reminding us that we can't just have patients come in with an ACS and just be like, oh, they're already on a high intensity stent, and we don't need to
It
do
was so
anything else.
easy. We had a good
But
decade where I didn't
it
have to
sounds
do
like easy
anything.
is not maybe not the right thing to do. No, I just, so you did allude to that. I mean, and maybe this ties into my next question, with the transitions and your team. How are you guys working to take some of these things in the guideline and implement them at your institution? Or have you guys started having, I know it's only been a couple of weeks, but have you already been thinking, or maybe you're already doing some of these things? How are we going to, do this for our patients and start getting them in the right direction?
Yeah, we had already been working on this quite a bit, not always down to 55, but certainly below 70, and with more liberal usage of non-statin therapies. So that, again, has been a difference. We always, of course, look at lipid panels for patients presenting with ACS. That should be, if there's ever like good quality initiatives for patients like with the registries, that should definitely be one that if you're not checking lipid panels in ACS events, it's probably not great care. And so I think where my brain goes is there's two things I want to see from that. Well, I guess first taking the statin naive patient is I kind of want to know, at least in my head, is a lipid disorder part of what drove this event? And so to that end, like, I'm really thinking about patients with potential heterozygous FH more than I ever did in the past. And now that we have a whole lot more tools towards that, if we get somebody with an LDL of 190, and this is their index event, we're far more aggressive towards trying to get that to goal with PCSK9s and things like that. Than we were before, to even where we're, I think, starting a lot of the paperwork hoops that go into, preventing patients from getting these like prior auth and things from the hospital side. One of the things, and we'll talk about this a little bit later with follow-up, is we actually have early follow-up clinics for all of these patients, which I think is the best practice, and it wasn't really quite addressed, I think, in these guidelines, but we have a great way to like hand off care in a relatively short period of time so that these things
Is
can
that
be
amongst your
implemented.
cardiology team, or is that through the pharmacy team, or both, or like the pharmacist
Both. So
engagement?
there, yeah, that we have a what we call post-MI clinic. So these patients are seen within, a couple of weeks of discharge at the latest, ideally within a week, and just making sure that all the things that we wanted to have happen from the hospital side are in fact happening. But it also is a great place to like hand off some of these issues. Like, hey, I've done some of the PA work on this, PCSK9 therapy, or hey, this is actually probably someone that would be, based on insurances, maybe better for the, long acting PCSK9 because of Medicare billing. So it's just a great way to communicate information for
Sure.
that. So we're a lot more aggressive with that. I think
And
for somebody,
relatedly, go ahead, sorry, finish your thought.
I was just gonna say, for people that are on like statins already, which of course you see a lot of people who are these days, I think we're I would say in about like 80% of them, we could probably get to goal with just the use of ezetimibe, which now being generic is pretty easy. That's a pretty easy win, I think, and that's an easy, that's not something I have to think too hard about, Craig, and I always like that in
You're
practice,
right.
is I can just
The low
low hanging
stakes,
fruit.
easy thought, right? Yeah, exactly. So are you guys spending more time and kind of you alluded to this, and this is definitely plays more or exists in the guideline, not necessarily full call out recommendations, but they do talk things about, SGLT2 inhibitors, GLP-1s and those types of things. Are you guys working to maybe identify those patients and transition them out into this clinic? What I feel like they're doing is they're setting us up for the world of CKM, which is becoming a cardio kidney metabolic a hot topic from the secondary prevention world. Are you guys starting to embed that thought process from the inpatient side of the transition or?
We are in that, and you can layer in obesity, at least from the there's a heavy component of M in that CKM as well, and so that's we're definitely trying to get there, but there's so many like barriers, at least for the things that are not oral pills, that all we can do is try to get the process started, I feel like, and then hand off what we can't get done. Of course, we're also under pressure on the inpatient side. I don't know about you guys, but our like bed capacity is like nil. So
Always.
if we're not getting people out, like, I can't spend an extra day to like haggle with an insurance company about what their preferred GLP-1 is. So we do try to, I think, put a lot of the work on our inpatient team with identifying these patients and at least getting things started, and in some cases, like getting success and getting some of these better therapies in patients' hands.
Was there any surprises to you in this set of guidelines? I know of one topic that a lot of people had angst over, but I wanted to see if that fell on your radar or.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, like, one thing I was still a little disappointed in is the anticoagulation section, at least for ACS, still feels like it's taken out of about the year 2000 or so, which I'm always a little annoyed with capped heparin dosing and PTT arbitrary PTT goals, which don't really have a huge basis. I know you're a big anticoag guy these days, so and it don't really have a huge basis, I think, in actual what the anticoagulant effect are. So I'd really like for that to be modernized, and
Right.
maybe that they're just saying there's not, we know the idea behind this, but we also have this 20,000 patient trial that did this way, and that's how we should do it. But
Well, now, from my understanding, they're doing some large PCORI-based studies with heparin and heparin dosing and ACTs and other, because there's a lot of people that
that'd
are
be
like, you
good.
don't even need to do ACTs anymore, right? Like, it doesn't make any sense in the lab to some extent to. So there actually is this like it's a 2x2 factorial design coming out of Canada that is like a large part registry, part claims-based data that's looking at ACT dosing. I know that last year at ACC I was at a session that we were talking about this, and of course ACC was in Atlanta, and it was the last session of the last day, and it was in the middle of the solar eclipse. And so I'm like one of the panelists. I'm like, nobody's coming to the session. But actually, it was very crowded. But anyways, they were talking about some of
Do you
these
have your
and some of these
glasses
things.
on?
Yeah, right. No, we were inside. You didn't have to do that. But I was like, no one's coming. We all the speakers and panelists like, no one's coming to this session. But we had a good attendance. But but I think there is more data. It's just surprising to your point. It's like you would think we would have solved this whole heparin thing by now, right? But obviously, things change, but heparin or anticoagulation.
Yeah, so I think that's always a little like frustrating. But
What are the?
probably the other one really, I think, is the beta blocker
Yeah, that was the one
issue.
that I've seen lots of consternation over. And, so what are your thoughts after the large trial came out last year and, where this was going to land? But.
I think they're still, it's still a way where they're still stratifying a little bit with the old guidelines, and beta blockers for acetamide were class 1A recommendation for the last 30 years. Probably from the advent of when there were ACS guidelines. It was probably the first like class 1A recommendation is like give a beta blocker. And so they're having trouble letting it go. I think, and and part of me gets that. I think I understand it, and I think the trial that, first there was of course Gamet not too long ago, which really, I think took a little bit of the wind out of the sails in terms of is this really a mortality reducing therapy or not? And all comers, which that child seemed to say no, you need to be at least a little bit more thoughtful. And so then we changed from like aggressive beta blockade strategies to just get it on when you can within 24 hours if you like, which didn't really adjust I think the trial that much, and what the findings were. And now with this reduced AMI trial, I think that the criticisms basically what that trial showed is there's no long-term mortality benefit for patients post uncomplicated ACS with beta blocker therapy, and that of course means somebody who's the garden variety comes in, gets revascularized, and has a preserved EF with no other real compelling indication. I think we already know the answer to that, and that these patients don't probably really benefit and probably despise, the healthcare system for putting them on a beta blocker
You're right.
to some degree. But criticisms of that, and I think why they didn't move is it's an open label trial. There's a lot of crossover, particularly as the years go on. It also was like a 3-year follow-up. So I think, I think they're going to want more resolution on the timeliness. So is there still value in the index hospitalization? Is it a month? Is it 6 months? Is it a year? And I think that's the kind of things they're looking to get a little bit more resolution on before we just throw it out. So we don't want to throw the baby
Yeah,
beta
out with the
blocker out
bathwater.
with the bathwater, right?
Right. No, and I think there's more data to come related to that. I know we've had other ones to this. To your point, I think that's what I gathered to be some of the thought processes as going through a couple of rounds of peer review or being on the peer review team to
That was probably
understand.
an interesting. I'm sure it was brought
Yeah.
up.
Yeah. So to see that piece. So my kind of last question, I have two last questions, and I know I appreciate your time. Any other final thoughts or comments? I know we didn't talk about everything, just so the audience is aware. There's some things I have some other guests that are going to allude to in future episodes, but any other thoughts or comments from your perspective, Steve, or
Yeah, I think I mentioned before, I think they talk a lot about cardiac rehab, but I really think early follow-up, at least in US-based practices, is extremely valuable and really allows us to, from a pharmacist side, hand off some of these detailed medication issues that come up a lot. I don't know about you all, but also using a lot of like ticagrelor up front can cause problems with insurance plans, and
right.
that there I think is some need to hand off some of those issues to
But I don't want to even
really.
get up in this can of worms. So I'm going to just ask it because this is a fun Steve topic. Have you kept up with all the drama with Ticagrelor between the FDA labeling
It's
and the
really
re the
interesting.
re the Lancet article that just came back out a few months ago, and what are your thoughts about all that?
I shared that article with our fellows. We still of course do a lot of ticagrelor, and I think there's always something that felt a little off with the PLATO trial, and I think that article really gets the op-ed about it's sort of like have we been too kind to ticagrelor over the years. And I think I wouldn't have thought too much more about it except the ISAR REACT5 trial came out where and that trial has potentially some issues as well. But and I thought this was really funny when you look in the guidelines at a glance. They, you know, of course, ICER React 5 is a European based trial. And so ESC now, the guidelines on their end are basically saying, you know, really you should use Prasugrel over ticagrelor. They have a kind of a softer recommendation in there. And they actually do a line by line in comparison to the ESC and the ACC/AHA guidelines. And they don't even address it like in the ACC/AHA guidelines, which is probably right. I don't know that anyone, you know, it's so hard to go into how a trial was done. And I think we always assume that, you know, did things like data collection and sites, and of course this has come up with other trials like TopCat is a great example as well, where there people were thinking there was really some funky things going on at some of these sites. So we always assume, I think, that the data that we're seeing is what's happening. And I think anyone who works with a large clinical trial knows like how incorrect that thinking probably is in a lot of cases. So, but you know, it's just hard for us to see behind the scenes of it. But you know, I sort of like the way ACC/AHA landed on this, which is that probably either of these drugs is fine. I don't know that we'll ever get a definitive answer one way or the other.
Yeah. Well, and it's definitely not probably at this point, right?
Yeah.
So, but so any other final thoughts or comments?
No, I think it's just a great modern guideline. I think it was nice to, it's one that I think really feels like it's looking towards, you know, an era where we're revascularizing, you know, well over 90% of STEMIs or thereabouts, and even identifying and triaging high risk ACS patients as well. I think, you know, the idea of integrating this all within a guideline is great because, you know, now with a lot of the testing precision, both in the cath lab with imaging, with high sensitivity troponin, like we really understand, I think, when there's really an ACS event or not, to the point that, you know, which we're not really addressing, I think, in this talk, but now we're down to like microvascular infarcts and MNOCA and that type of stuff that we never were able to see before. And that probably is where a bit of, you know, future development, I think, will occur is how do we address those patients a little bit better, because a lot of the data is lacking with those patients. But overall, I think it's a great update, and I think it, like I said, it's just the first one to me that feels modern and it fully divorced from the supply demand era of the past.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. And I still think, since we are pharmacists and this is pharmacists saying, there's still lots of opportunity for pharmacists to be engaged and create opportunity and connect dots, and not
Oh
just with
yeah.
transitions, but they're clearly, you know, like I take the DAP thing and I always joke and I'm like, I remember the good old days when it was like 12 months, that's all we had to worry about. And now,
And we
you
only have
know,
clopidogrel, you
right.
know.
I mean, it's like,
Yeah.
you know, I was like, oh, the good old days. Now it's like, well, you could have an entire day of conversation around antiplatelet therapy. So my last question for you, Steve, this is not a clinical question, and we kind of did this a little bit maybe at the front. I always like to let people know there's other perspectives besides being a pharmacist or working in cardiovascular space, but just, and I kind of maybe stole this from some New York Times things and expanded on it. Is there any things that you're reading or watching or listening to, things that you've really connected with that you would recommend to our teams or audience? It can be both enlightening or just this is fun or we've enjoyed it or something to that effect. So.
Yeah, I'm like pretty hot in the middle of the second season of Severance right
Oh, yes.
now.
I haven't gotten to
So,
watch that one yet. It's
oh
supposedly really good,
man,
right?
it gives you a lot of you know, it's just a funny thing, like being where I'm at in life. You know, I'm a bit of a mid-career person, and it's just a great commentary on like going to work and coming home as
It was
well from a meta perspective, you know,
right.
because we all feel like our lives are a little bit separate, you know, in some cases with, you know, there's the time I spend with at home with family and the kids, and then the time I go into the office. And it's just you know, independent of the great storytelling in that show, it's just a great commentary on, you know,
No, I'll
what it
have to
feels
start
like.
watching. I've wanted to watch it because I see a lot of things about it. I just recently started watching the one about the families with the billionaires, not Severance.
Succession.
Yeah,
Succession,
Succession.
another S word, right? So I just started watching that, but we'll have to do that.
We left off on that one. It's a great show, but I had so I feel like in a TV show I need someone to root for, and I was having a hard time grasping onto
Identifying
anyone in that show. a There's no
way into the story.
protagonist,
So anyways, very good. Well, I appreciate your time, and to the audience, if there are other things or questions, and so Stephen, if people wanted to find you, and you could say, oh, there's no way to find me, but if people wanted to find you, is there any way and that they could find you to reach out to you or anything?
Yeah, I suspect my email is out there somewhere if you Google me. I'm maybe one of the few people like still hanging on to a Twitter slash X account, so you can find me at CardiacRx down there. I should do this Blue Sky thing. I hear some people
Or
are over there now. Yeah, transition.
So no, very good. That's great.
But
So
yeah, you can find me anywhere on the web. I'll I man the Edgar Allan Poe dorm. A couple times a month. So if you just happen to camp
you're
out there.
in on the campus.
Yeah.
So well, very good. Well, I appreciate your time, and extra special thank you to all the Pharmacy Times teams who help us produce these episodes, and join us in the next few weeks when we'll have an additional guest to provide some additional layering to the ACS guidelines, maybe with a focus on the LV thrombus piece and some more about anticoagulation. So I appreciate everyone's time, and thank you for joining us.